A few times during this week, Bruni referred to things like the hindrances as visitors. And in the suttas, the Buddha at one point says that the mind, or the heart, or it is citta, the mind is luminous except for I forget exactly what word he uses, but to paraphrase, except for the hindrances that visit. This idea that there are these unwholesome mental states that arise, and that to somehow view them as visitors, that rather than inherent in who we are, that we're not inherently sinful, we're not inherently bad, we're not inherently wrong, we're not inherently caught up in these attachments and clingings that we have, but they come and they visit. And it's good to be friendly to visitors. But certain visitors, you don't want to encourage them to stay either. In fact, what's nice is to be friendly and then let them dissolve. Or I think of some of these things like thought bubbles. And they certainly don't feel like that when they're in the cot in the middle of them. But, you know, these wonderful thought bubbles that we're supposed to have above our heads. And Dharma practice is a little bit like popping the bubble. And so all these bubbles we blow ourselves up with, and we pop the bubbles of all the hindrances. The point being that the hindrances are not inherently who we are, and if there's something that we are, which Buddhism is pretty shy to say exactly, but they refer to the mind as luminous. And I like this because of how it speaks of something that's something wonderful and beautiful. It's a very interesting term, this word citta. It's a very common word in the suttas, citta. It means, usually translated as mind. One of the things that's very fascinating about the use of this word in the suttas is that many of the common parts of who we are, even consciousness and feelings and perceptions and sensations and all that, are repeatedly referred to as being impermanent, not self, and dukkha, and unsatisfactory. But the citta is never referred to that way. The citta kind of gets off. You know, it doesn't get referred to that way. Citta has a little different status in the suttas. And we certainly don't take it as being a permanent or a self, but it's kind of looked upon positively. Maybe it's like an umbrella term for the overall functioning of the inner psyche, as opposed to some particular thing. Anything particular is impermanent and not self. But somehow the gestalt, the overall process is treated in a nice way. And so one way or the other, whether the mind is luminous or the mind is kind of a precious thing, it's part of you, it's in you. And to be able to clear the hindrances well enough so you can see this inner beauty, this inner freedom, this inner goodness that's there, is one of the great blessings. And one of the visitors that will make it obscure and make it all not so nice is selfishness and conceit. So to have this beautiful citta, this beautiful luminous mind and this innate goodness, and then say, oh boy, my hot stuff, you know, I'm special now, that just that's just another visitor. That's one of those trains we say no to. You can actually, if you really go into this practice deep enough, it doesn't make sense to be selfish anymore, because you can feel how it darkens things or obscures things or makes it difficult to see what's going on. And it hurts. So this idea that there's something really great here in you, and that we can rest there, we can find our home there, we can take refuge there, we can find the Dharma there, our freedom here, is, I think, a very positive message and very encouraging. And then we use mindfulness to find our way. And I love this analogy that Buddha talked about, it has to do with monkeys in India. And he said that if the monkeys go, he's there at the, Buddha lived kind of near the foot of the Himalayas, so that's his reference point. So if you go up into the Himalayas high enough, there are steep cliffs and big chasms, and if the monkeys go up there high up, it's actually dangerous for them there. They'll slip on the icy rocks and stuff. But then they come down, and if they go down into the plains, away from the forests, where there's farmers and people hunting, then it's dangerous for them to get caught. But the midpoint between the high mountains and the plains, there's an area of the jungle where it's so thick with forest that the hunters can't get in, but it's safe for the monkeys. And that part of the forest is called, what's called the monkeys' native land, their home country. And actually, I think they used literally the word is their ancestral lands. And then the Buddha said, and our, as human beings, our ancestral land, our home country, our native place, is the four foundations of mindfulness, is the places where we center ourselves on ourselves through mindfulness. And the idea that we carry within us a home, that we carry within us a portable home, we carry within us not just simply a home or ancestral land, but we carry with us a place that's of safety, where the hunters can't get us, and where the hindrances can't get us. And there's also, you know, over and over again, you see these suttas referring back to ourselves as a good place, back within ourselves as something that's a beautiful thing. And one of the things that's possible is that we can do enough of this mindfulness, see clearly enough, that we discover a place where the heart is free. And the freedom of the heart is the best. It's free of suffering, it's free of clinging. And the way the Buddha talked about that, the heart becomes not dependent on anything and not clinging to anything in the world. It's a beautiful thing to no longer depend, your well-being, your happiness, is not dependent on things of the world. You're not clinging to things of the world, but you're at home in yourself. You discover the freedom, the luminosity, the beauty that's here. And so this practice of mindfulness, that's for the Buddha, that's where it's going. And in some ways, the practice of mindfulness is pretty simple. On the other hand, if you do it well and thoroughly, it goes really far. It goes as far as you can possibly go as a human being towards freedom. And if you just begin to get a glimpse of how good it is in you, in your heart, the miracle is you start being able to see it in other people, even if they don't see it. And to be able to appreciate other people's beauty and depth and wonderfulness and kind of be able to look past their hindrances, if they just happen to have them that day, and be able to see through it and see something that's really beautiful, tender, something that's worth bowing down to, valuing, celebrating. And no matter who it is, anyone you encounter, Wouldn't that be a great world if anyone you encounter, you felt ready, like just to bow in appreciation, bow in celebration of who they are, and their place in the world, and how we share this world together. So I hope that your time here at IRC in this community-supported retreat process has been meaningful for you. And I hope that the sense of us being a community and practicing together is something that has touched you, or you found a value and appreciate that. It's one of the aspirations here, that we really learn to appreciate each other, system of mutual support. And so that maybe when we leave here, we're more ready to see people as beautiful, as valuable, as respect-worthy, and kind of see past their hindrances, unless they're causing too much trouble for us. And and I also hope that this theme of the hindrances for this week was done in such a way that the hindrances are now seen as something that you can wisely be present with without being in conflict with. There's no need to be in conflict with hindrances, no reason to be aversive to the hindrances, no need to see them as being some kind of terrible flaw. There's no need to see them as they define who you are. It's possible to relate to these hindrances in a non-conflictive way, and at the same time, not be in their spell, not be caught by them. And that's very different than how some people see them, where they have a very negative relationship to them. They're like the enemy, and we have to get rid of the enemy, and, you know, it's like a war against part of who we are. I hope that there's no, we're not at war against any part of who we are. That there's a whole other way of being that, with ourselves, that can be in harmony with who we are. And if things are not so useful, if visitors are not so useful, maybe we love them into dissolving. Maybe by just kind of holding them with our kindness, without our non-reactivity, and not feeding them, that, you know, they'll be quite content to just vanish. Wouldn't that be nice? So, for this retreat, we haven't taken any questions in the hall. We don't often do that at IRC. But some of you might have questions from the teachings, something you'd like to ask us. And at this point in the retreat, it's nice to have a little more energy in the hall, kind of getting ready now to leave tomorrow. And so we're kind of doing this rhythm of being a little more energetic and then going back into silence. Tomorrow morning we'll do that some more and back into silence. And that rhythm going back and forth is actually an important part of the practice, and what you get to practice with as we do that kind of is part of the preparing to leave. So if any of you have any questions, and maybe Abraham it's on, so. And and if maybe we could start with Bruni and go back and forth. There's a teaching in Buddhism that you get really good merit if you ask questions.
No.
Yeah, I'm just curious if Bruno, you might speak to one thing. Gil mentioned the sort of aspiration or kind of movement toward, sorry, my voice is interesting. towards more independence of the Dharma, or not being so dependent on conditions. And then, of course, there's the fact that we are dependent on everyone and everything and very much connected to all things. So just to mention this and see what you have to say, kind of these two paradox, what is this, and both feeling true.
You know, I will say that through the practice, we learn to be connected and interdependent. We practice and we learn to live, you know, relating, but also staying within our field, staying with our within our native land. And in that, we learn to also relate in a way that when we connect with others or with the world, that with the wide world, that we bring ourselves in a way that, you know, we're not depending in a way that, depending on others, in a way that we give away our choice and our way to be in the world as unique people, you know, holding ourselves, going from being Gregor to being connected to everyone.
And listening to Bruni, I had an analogy, because I think that's not really a paradox unless you take things that are different from each other as being similar. Mm. You know, you kind of an unfortunate mixing of different categories. So, for example, if we look around the room and all of our people here, and we've been interconnected and interdependent for sure during this week, no doubt about it. And we come into this room, and certain way we're interdependent in the room, and we're connected in the room, and you can look around and see and feel that, you know, this community that's been here, this that's been possible by being in this room. But part of what this our being in this room has been dependent on is all this empty space that the room has made for us. And that empty space is not dependent on the people who are in it. So at some point, some aspect of the mind, and some Buddhists like to think of it as some as awareness like space, awareness doesn't get hooked on anything, it doesn't get contracted around anything. The awareness is kind of free and has lots of space to hold everything. And it holds all the things that are interconnected. But the awareness is not dependent on all the things that's held. Because it's like space, something like that.
The question that's been on my mind for actually quite a while, but what you just said about awareness brought it up for me again, in that if there's no self, who is it that is aware?
It's a reasonable question to ask. And Buddhism is completely uninterested in answering it. It's a nice, interesting thing to consider, all the ramifications of that question, meaning in a philosophy class. But for the purposes of practice, it has no value or purpose. And it's kind of, you know, academic. And it's probably a pretty unsatisfying answer.
Thank you. I think I heard you guys talk about the hindrances at one point as symptoms, and I think it was alongside a discussion about it being them being visitors, but I'm curious about them as being sort of representatives or messengers of something that's deeper or more fundamental, or to say like a larger issue that they're representing. And so I'm curious, in practical terms, how you practice with the hindrance and sort of seeing its cessation, but then also going to a deeper level and seeing why is this happening, you know, as opposed to some spontaneous arising. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah. You know, for me, there are symptoms when I see maybe manifestations of greed, aversion, delusion, if I'm aware, if at some point I become aware of it. I may see that maybe as a symptom or a sign that there's a possibility that a hindrance may be visiting. So I don't know if I would call the hindrances as symptoms, but I can see symptoms or signs, like I was talking today, of seeing them arising or coming. They're coming, and as they show up, then through Bela I will explore more. I don't know if Gil, do you want to add anything else?
We've now had three men ask questions. I wonder if we have someone who's not a man.
You know, it's funny you should say that. Often when I was walking, there were only men in the garden walking. My question is kind of a follow-on to that. Bruni, you said at one point when you prepared for today's talk that you ignored the fear. And there's always the question for me, the balance between the exploration of a kind of the follow-on of that question, the exploration of how much should I tend the fear and how much should I not believe in it or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. When I talked about choosing consciously, I mentioned that I was at some point I chose consciously to ignore the fear. At that point, I felt I knew it well enough. There was something that it was telling me I know this well. Is fear. Do I choose to stay here, caught up in it, or do I choose to ignore the influence, the impact, and complete what I'm doing? Does that help?
Because you've already spent the time getting to know it.
Yes. Yes, it was enough really for clarifies. Me to see, okay, enough. I'm going to ignore it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I have a question about the classification of the hindrances, because in the meditation technique that I have been involved in, the main two feelings that we deal with is craving and aversion. And why these five categories? And do you feel that all our emotions or all our all hindrances can fall into one of these five categories?
I don't know. I don't know if we need to put it all the things that hinder the mind, all the challenges of the mind, into those five. These are just the most powerful ones, or the ones that, for some reason, that was singled out as the ones that are most challenge our ability to get concentrated. So the others can operate as well, but maybe as we get deeper and deeper in concentration, there's something about these five that are operate a little bit more actively or more a little bit more as hindrances for the deeper and deepening of concentration. But there's no need to limit it to it. It's just a convenient number, and you know, if it's too list is too long, you have to bring a checklist with you to the meditation. And but this thing about the Guenka practice you did is a very effective practice that is partly effective because of how much it's simplified things into kind of a very simple, and so the mind gets can be very simple to uncomplicate. Just do this basic simple thing, but our life is a little more complicated than that simplicity. So sometimes it's nice to have a wider array of things to recognize. And sometimes when we're a little bit more specific in the mindfulness, if we recognize things more specifically, it's easier to be free of it. So, restlessness and anxiety or regret, if you really see it for what it is, as that, sometimes it's easier to let go than just see it as something as craving. But in the Guenka tradition, I think the reference point often for what they're doing there, or they're talking about, is deep states of concentration. And that's where you want to have things really simple. And there maybe just almost just for or against is, it's all you need. Just feel the mind going for something or against something, or towards or away. And that's just that simplicity is all you need. And so that's quite powerful. I think that's, and that's a kind of a natural direction in which the practice goes anyway, because as we settle down further and further in practice, the kind of five hindrances fall away, and they're no longer really that relevant. And then just this for or against or craving and aversion by itself becomes the reference point. So it's a little bit state-specific, those teachings. But when we get to kind of up in more complicated lives, we want to be able to, some of us want to practice there too and find our stability, find our freedom in that world too. And then it's useful to have a little bit bigger or wider map of what the mind does. And so the five hindrances is part of this wider map that we can use to navigate and understand ourselves. Does that make sense?
It does. So you would actually think that most feelings would fall into one of the five, or not all feelings, but it's five umbrella categories that
I don't know if they are, in terms of hindering, things that hinder ourselves. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I would say, one of the issues about the five hindrances is the fourth one is literally restlessness and regret. And we often say restlessness and worry or anxiety, but that's not literally what it is in the ancient world. It's only in America. So the question is, why isn't fear in there? And isn't fear a big hindrance for people? And now one answer is that sometimes fear is healthy and appropriate, and sometimes it's a hindrance. And so you don't want to put it in that list because that kind of makes it look like it's always a problem. So that maybe there could be a, like parentheses at the end of it with number six, sometimes fear. And then doubt often has delusion as part of it, but it's also possible to have delusion without any doubt. And that's very unfortunate.
So when you're having a multiple hindrance attack, what's the most skillful way to use Bella?
To use Bella.
So you do you do one at a time, or you kind of go for the trifecta?
For the multiple hindrance attack thing? Yeah. I think we're supposed to be our own teacher in this practice. So just try to figure it out on your own. It's the effort to try to figure it out which actually helps to strengthen the practice. And so there's all kinds of options, trial and error, and see how it... Because if I gave you an answer, which might be my answer, it might be fit for you, it might not. It might fit for one or two people, but not for others. I mean, we're all so different, so it's nice to have these different kind of set of things to do. And then you kind of find your own way with them. And some people might like to do, spend a whole day with just the B and then the E and just kind of really get to know it. And some people want to, kind of look at all of it together or all kinds of ways. So I'm a little bit reluctant to specify, if you don't mind.
Getting the voice back is a little difficult. Just going back to fear, that's another, I just don't see the situation that fear would not be a hindrance. So if you could just explain that.
Traditionally, the healthy fear is fear of causing harm. Fear of hurting someone. That's considered healthy.
I guess I don't see how fear is helpful in that.
How fear is helpful?
There's the knowing what's skillful and unskillful, but it seems like fear is actually, it's related to agitation and worry, or it's also, I'm just not getting that.
Yeah, I think the fear of causing harm can get people to drive more carefully. So I think, for example, fear of the consequences of our unethical actions. Help some people be more ethical. If we have people that we respect a lot, hold up in esteem, wise people, elders or something, there is a kind of healthy fear of doing something they would disapprove of. Should I go and after the retreat, should I go and I can't think of anything. if everyone had to announce what they're going to do for the tomorrow afternoon to everyone you've been meditating with for a week, and maybe most of you are not going to do anything interesting, but maybe one of you might be doing something that's so interesting that you actually don't want to say anything because you're afraid because it's kind of unethical. the Buddhist tradition says that there's a fear that's considered healthy and appropriate, and rather than limiting us. It's a fear that prevents us from becoming limited.
protect us.
It protects us. So maybe do one more.
Could either of you talk a little bit about regret and its connection to restlessness? I just have a little bit of a hard time seeing that, but also if we could explore it a little bit in terms of understanding it a little better.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my experience, situations in which there has been regret, I have lost sleep. I have had agitation about why I didn't. There's a lot of questioning in the mind, agitation in the mind, trying to figure out why I did not act in certain way or why I didn't speak in certain way. So even though when, you know, we talk about restlessness, there's also like a reference to the future. There is the agitation, there's a similar physical response, at least for me, in addition to other physical sensations, that regret, that when I'm dealing with regret, that come up. Does that help?
Yes. Okay. So in a few minutes, Abraham is going to make the kind of begin the kind of closing announcements, things you need to know for the next little while. And as you can imagine, like the clockwork that the IRC is, everything you need to know is going to be revealed at the right time. And one of the things that Abraham's going to say is that just trust the schedule, trust everything, just follow along. But at this kind of juncture of the retreat, where we're kind of beginning to move out from the retreat, and we're still kind of very much in it, I want to highlight something for everyone, because there is this this little slogan, you know, the medium is the message. And so how how IRC is organized, how it's run, is also part of the teaching here, or even say more deeply, how it's set up here is meant to be part of what nourishes our hearts and nourishes the practice that we do here. And so I'd like to highlight this nourishment that you've all been swimming in or during this week, that IRC exists because of tremendous amount of people's generosity and inspiration, and people who really not only valued what we're about here, but wanted it to be available to people like you, so you could be part of this community. And so a lot of people were inspired to create a retreat center where everything's offered freely. There's some idea that when things are offered freely, it's not a transaction, it's not an exchange, that it's a lot easier to discover how to be free, how to be able to have the heart relax into itself and receive and give without dependencies back and forth, without expectations back and forth, without holding and clinging to something. So the idea is that Dharma flowers the best in each of us in a field of generosity, of goodwill, of gratitude, and a lot of goodness. And so there's tremendous amount of goodness that's here. And one of the ways that I like to think of it, it's a little bit, you know, if you've never been here before, it's hard to imagine. But I was here since the beginning, and just about everything that your eyes can land on and see, it's something that's here, I know who gave time and attention and love to select that thing so that it could be here for us to just make the best thing possible. So someone who's a volunteer would do research on lights and switches and colors of paints and screws. And I don't know if you notice how many magnets we use here, but someone did research on magnets. And you know, it goes on and on and on. Everything you can see has someone's love that's in it. I mean, how many places you can go in the world and that's what you have? When we opened here, we had a first kind of inaugural retreat, and that opening evening, it was a very nice coincidence that this wonderful African-American Theravada nun named Panawati came and visited. And she came up to me and said, "Gil, I travel all over the country. She meets a lot of people. And there's a lot of people in the United States who want IRC to work." I was kind of, you know, so stunned to hear this and so kind of heart-opening. Really? People all over? And I think so many people are inspired by this model of freely given, volunteer support. It's all done by volunteers here. Everything's freely given. And it's all freely given because it's all been freely given to IRC in order to make it that way. That's what people are inspired to do. And so she said, all over the country, she said, that people want this to work. I think it's a great model. And to me, it's been one of the bright lights of my life to have this. And it's kind of, sometimes I pinch myself when I come down here. And sometimes I have to remember how much generosity and goodwill went into this place when I kind of think, wow, I mean, this is a little bit too opulent. It's a little bit too much. when we were looking for a place, I really thought we were going to get like a little bit rickety, moldy little Boy Scout cabin place in the damp woods. You know, that's what we could afford, but then I think of like this, you know, Buddhism shouldn't have this kind of luxury that we have here. But then I remember it's people who really wanted us to have this. There was all these people supported it to be this way. And so we have this beautiful, clean model that I hope that inspires mindfulness, inspires goodness, inspires generosity, inspires the practice in people. And my hope is that what we do here is contagious, so that maybe you'll go out into your communities and maybe something like this will spring up other places around the country and around the world. I think it's just fantastic. So that's what I wanted to share with you. So maybe as you, last hours you're here, you can, if you haven't imbibed, drunk enough of this nectar, then you can take in a little bit more over the next hours and look at all the things that you can see in the building. Really? Someone thought about that? Great. So thank you.